Welcome to another week of Bitcoin Jam. Glad to see you guys again. You know, we feel like we're spending all our time in the group chat talking about various things. So cool that we get a chance to gather and digest it real time. I almost liked what we did the last couple weeks was we caught Moneyball on a hot mic saying something kind of controversial. And I wonder if it's a good start for this week. So this, you know, the one thing that I keep getting hit up by all my friends are like, what is up with this Willow quantum computing thing? Is it going to kill Bitcoin? And I would say like, it's all real time evolving and we're trying to learn about this real time. But the big news was that Google came out with, you know, this quantum computing announcement that I think had sort of been in preprints and sort of had some knowledge about its existence before, but it actually kind of dropped in, I think, one of the major like Science or Nature, one of the major scientific journals. And so that got everybody in the Bitcoin community asking like, what is going on with quantum computing? And are we about to, you know, is Bitcoin dead? So let's start it off spicy. Is Bitcoin dead?
Hold on. Let me check. When's the last block that was mine? It looks like the internet's dead. Okay, there. All right.
Okay. So Willow is ascended.
So I mean, Bitcoin's not dead, but it's a great topic to talk about. I mean, I think we should preface it first saying none of us are cryptography experts, quantum computing experts. So I think our discussion will be really good maybe to help people think through what are the right questions to ask and what yep. are the right things to be thinking about. So let's talk about some of that. One thing that I always ask is, right, I just feel like the internet at large remains still, it's still bigger than Bitcoin. So any kind of concern about quantum computing breaking the discrete log problem or solving that problem and rendering elliptical curve cryptography kind of moot, that doesn't just threaten Bitcoin, it threatens all security on the internet. And like really huge portions of society. So it's this is far bigger than a Bitcoin problem. So one thing we should all be looking for is like, what are other communities? How are they thinking about it? How are they reacting to it? What are they doing? In particular, internet security. And I don't know the answer to that, but I don't really see panic or people concerned about that. I see way more yep. panic about Bitcoin than I do about the internet at large. So should there be panic about the internet at large? Is there panic? What are people doing about it? That's one area that people should be exploring and we should be learning more about and we can talk more about in this show as we learn.
Yeah, like Bitcoin panic should be a subset of internet panic, not the main course.
So that's one, I think, one important point. And I guess sort of the corollary to that, since I'm not aware of panic for internet large, I'm not super panicked about Bitcoin. But secondly, like I don't think we should stick our heads in the sand. I mean, these are reasonable questions to be asked. At the very least, people into Bitcoin should like have solid, credible answers instead of just brushing it off as like, you know, not a concern. Even if the reality is this is not going to be a concern for 50 years. Okay, well, you Bitcoiners talk about Bitcoin lasting for hundreds of years or millennia or whatever. So what yep. are you going to do when this is a concern in 50 years? So it's a very reasonable question to ask, and we need to keep developing better answers.
And is you mentioned discrete log problem. I've heard of discrete log contracts, but I didn't know of discrete log problem. Is that part of how like ECDSA 256 works, or is that...
Yeah, it's part of elliptical curve cryptography in general. So, you know, the basics of that are you start with a private key, which is just a really big number. And as the name suggests, that's what you want to keep private. You don't want to share that with anyone else. From that number, you can generate a public key, which as the name suggests, you can make that public, give it to people. And of course, this is not Bitcoin specific. It's used for all kinds of communication. Signal uses this and all kinds of applications.
And that's used even in HTTPS, right? So if you go visit HTTPS, Amazon.com, yeah. and you want to make sure you're actually putting your credit card into Amazon, that's right. the same cryptography.
Yep. And so underlying the security is the premise that you can multiply big numbers. There are known algorithms that can be done on regular CPUs, regular general computation, that can multiply really big numbers quickly. But the discrete log problem is that you cannot use a general computer to do division of really large numbers. What that means is that you can take a private key and you can generate a public key because you're doing multiplication. But to go backwards, if you have a public key, you can't generate the private key unless you break the discrete log problem and you can do division of really large numbers. And so there's proofs that we can't do this with general computers, but Shor's algorithm from this guy in, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, developed an algorithm that with a hypothetical quantum computer that you could efficiently do division of large numbers. So the break here would be like, if that became feasible, you know, no one's Bitcoin would be safe, but no internet security would be safe. And also it breaks a lot of data that's encrypted too. So you might think all your messages over Signal are safe, but all of a sudden, boom, they're not safe because they can be broken. Sorry, Max.
Yeah. No, I think it's also just worth taking a moment to pause on cryptography in general and the magic of it, because all the stuff that you're explaining, Steve, is obviously correct and it's very interesting and sort of technical. But one thing, you know, when I really went down this rabbit hole deeply in 2017, trying to understand like how does ECDSA work and all that stuff, the thing that I really stuck with me actually was a passage from one of our favorite mutual authors, DK, Kevin Kelly, in his book Out of Control. And he makes this claim that, you know, cryptography basically is essentially the closest thing to magic that we have, although perhaps quantum is the next form of magic, and is based on, you know, we have the technical understanding of everything as Steve's saying, but if you kind of just put on the caveman view for a minute looking at it, it's this kind of really magical, weird property of the universe in a way that it's easier to multiply than it is to divide. And that asymmetry is an asymmetry that in some ways, you know, one could make the argument suggest that the universe is, at least with our current understanding, protecting individual rights in a way, or allowing decentralization to thrive, because so much of technology is centralizing. But this one weird kind of like inexplicable fact about the universe means that asymmetry for the individual to protect information and use weapons grade munitions, as cryptography used to be called, on par with what a state or a really large actor can do is absolutely incredible. And so that's something that I think is just, it's worth, you know, taking a moment to just like, it always blows my mind that this is a fact that even exists in the universe. And right. I don't think that quantum computing, obviously, you know, that's a whole different set of magic. The idea that you can have, instead of just a zero or a one, potentially something both being a zero and a one simultaneously. Certainly not an expert there, but that's another form of magic. My best understanding is that we're not fundamentally breaking this principle of the universe yet, that asymmetrically allows the individual to protect against the larger actor, because we've had lots of different codes that have been broken, you know, at different points of human history, the Enigma code, I mean, all kinds of cryptography, and we always find new areas of that. And so from just doing, you know, sort of a cursory glance at this in the last couple of days, obviously, again, caveat, not an expert, but it does seem like there's lots of PhDs in universities who are, you know, pretty far into quantum resistant cryptography based on things like lattice cryptography, stuff that I'm certainly not an expert on, but there are fields where this is actively being researched outside of the Bitcoin community. And also from companies, not only like Signal, but my understanding is like Apple, for example, has a ton writing on cryptography. They're employing some of the best minds in this. So it does appear that this principle of the universe is not going to be yet broken by new magic. The big question in my mind with all of the quantum stuff is just how fast is the rate of progress for quantum mm-hmm. versus getting these new algorithms ready for Bitcoin? And once they are ready, how fast can we actually roll something out? Those are questions I still am not, you know, fully clear on yet.
So you mentioned, or real quick, you mentioned universe, but which universe? Because exactly. Another
right.
I read. Let me read it. This is from the Google Willow announcement. This is mind-boggling number exceeds known timescales in physics and vastly exceeds the age of the universe. It lends credence to the notion that quantum computation occurs in many parallel universes, in line with the idea that we live in a multiverse. Maybe another question we should ask is like, does Bitcoin break in certain universes and not others? Who knows?
Or is there a Bitcoin that hasn't been invented in a certain universe and you too can be your own Satoshi? You just have to redefine the universe.
I right. believe that was Vitalik and Joe Lubin.
They're actually in another universe, yeah.
And actually, just one last note on that while we're going sort of cosmic. I mean, these are all great questions. I think it's also fair to say, to the best of our knowledge, no one's freaking out in the internet and Bitcoin yet. But, you know, we don't know yet. We're figuring all this out in real time. And these are reasonable questions. But did you guys ever watch the show Mr. Robot?
I've seen a few of the episodes, yeah. I know the general vibe.
Yeah. If you haven't, it's super, it's the only, I'm not into TV. It's the only show that I've watched multiple times and I absolutely love, blows my mind. I think the cypherpunks out there will all get a lot out of it. Bitcoin, I think it was filmed in 2014, the season that featured Bitcoin heavily. So they were kind of ahead of their time. The first couple of seasons rely heavily on this idea of the global financial system collapsing. So there's stuff around Bitcoin. In their case, instead of CBDCs, it's Evil Corp, you know, their currency. So there's a lot about sort of Bitcoin and the individual versus, you know, collective. But then the later episodes, without giving too much away, do a lot with quantum. And so one of my big takeaways is I need to go back and watch those last couple seasons. Because whoever did the research for that show, they seem to be onto something.
So I, yeah.
About like actually, you know, what do we know and what do we not know about? Is this a problem in 3 years or 30 years or never? It's impossible. Because actually someone who I don't know who it was just posted the Bitcoin dev list saying that, you know, they're claiming that the elliptical curve behind Bitcoin is going to be cracked by 2027, so 3 years. So there's people making those types of claims.
Then that's unrelated to quantum. That's just regular computation.
That's quantum.
No, it's been proven that it can't be broken with general computation. Got it. So, most of the smart, credible developers I know and cryptographers within Bitcoin generally, I think, feel like it's decades away, but they don't dismiss it, but decades away. But what do we know? Willow, I think it was announced like 105 qubits or something, and maybe other computers have been developed by someone that are on the order of 100 qubits. I believe we've all seen that using Shor's algorithm to break SEC256K. SEC P256K1, which is the curve used by Bitcoin, would take on the order of a million qubits. That still doesn't tell me a whole lot, though, because like how we don't know how quickly it's going to accelerate from 100 to a million. I've also seen some people claim that you can take a lot of like 1,000 qubit computers and network them together to get to a million. I don't know. Is that how it works? Is that feasible? I don't know. But I don't think we should like immediately dismiss it saying like, oh, 100's a long ways away from a million, so like we don't have to worry about it. We should inquire and ask more questions. But that's one aspect. I mean, the other rudimentary thing I know about quantum computers, it's hard to like keep them running for very long. So like how does that play a role? Like qubits versus how long you can run the computer. It seems like that's two separate related factors, or you know, they're related to the problem, but like two separate factors. And a third is error correction. And that's what I think, my understanding of the real big breakthrough in Willow. It's not like the 105 qubits, it's that Google did make a breakthrough on error correction. And someone who understands this a lot better than me told me that prior to that, it was a super linear problem. Like for each computation, positive computation you did, or productive computation, each incremental contribution, you know, positive contribution actually increased the number of errors in a super linear way. And with the Willow announcement, it actually reversed. It's like sublinear. So that seems like a huge breakthrough.
And that's as you're adding new qubits. Like if you go from, you know, 50 to 100, you would normally have, before Willow, you would have super linear accrual of errors. And now you get sublinear accrual of errors.
That's what I was told.
But and that's a big breakthrough that presumably.
But it's like another, I mean, so I think the best we can do for people is like suggest like here's areas to like inquire, ask questions, learn more about, including ourselves.
Yeah.
One big question I have then is, okay, let's say, you know, whatever, there's some confidence range that's not going to happen in the next 3 years, but we don't know. Like, let's say something does break in the next 3 years or even sooner. What would happen? I mean, it's not like the Bitcoin community is completely head in the sand. People have talked about this. Satoshi talked about this, you know, well over, you know, whatever, 14, 15 years ago. But practically, the ECDSA curve we're using gets broken. What next to you?
Yep. And another factor to that is like, or in terms of what happens, it also depends on like, how does the attack reveal itself? Meaning, do we have like 20 years heads up? Like, meaning like we're getting some heads up now, but is it just going to gradually get better and better? And then like, we're sort of like, it becomes more and more obvious that, oh, we're 7 years away. We're 5 years away. It's going to happen in 6 months. Like if we keep getting those heads up, obviously we can both prepare a lot better, to treat it with urgency, and also any kind of like time frames and deadlines we can give to companies and individual holders of Bitcoin, like you need to take action. The bigger the heads up, the more practical that becomes. Or it's just out of the blue, one attacker gets this power and uses it and just instantaneously steals a ton of Bitcoin.
Also, like how would it impact Bitcoin? Is it that it like makes wallet, like makes the private keys associated with a public address you can find accessible then?
Yeah.
Is that the core of what?
Let's start Bitcoin mining. I mean, several parts of the Bitcoin software uses a hashing algorithm, SHA-256. Bitcoin mining in particular uses that. It's vulnerable to quantum computing, but not as bad. Another algorithm by a gentleman named Grover's algorithm, reduces the complexity to find preimages for hashes. But my understanding is it wouldn't destroy mining. It would just, whoever has that capability would be able to mine blocks just vastly more efficiently than anyone else. As long as that
would power, like difficulty adjustment basically take care of it?
As long as that's not centralized power, right?
Yeah.
If it's okay. One entity that has that power, then yes, the difficulty would adjust, but only they would be able to mine blocks. So as long as that capability is distributed well enough and ideally just open source and anyone can do it, I think that's no big deal. I mean, there'd be like this interim period of a massive difficulty adjustment, but we've already been through that. Like when we went from like CPUs to ASICs, right. that happened in a very short period of time. We've already dealt with that. Obviously, Bitcoin's bigger now. We need to think through the ramifications a little bit, but I think it would largely be a hiccup. The more concerning thing is what you mentioned, David, which is basically any coins that are locked up, different Bitcoin. There's different ways to lock up Bitcoin. Lock up meaning like if someone sends you Bitcoin, you generate a Bitcoin address, it gets sent to that address. The type of script used for that, the code used for that, there's over the years have been a number of different ways and mechanisms to lock up Bitcoin. People might have heard of some of these, like Taproot or SegWit or more recent ones. You might have heard of like pay to pub key, and there's all these like very technical terms. Some of them expose the public key and some do not. So the ones that expose the public key are absolutely vulnerable to a quantum break. And so anyone with that power could generate the private keys for all of those Bitcoin and spend all those Bitcoin, take all those Bitcoin. So in particular, the notable one is Satoshi. So it's believed that Satoshi mined something like 750,000 to a million Bitcoin based on various patterns that can be observed. And, you know, those coins have never been moved. We don't know who Satoshi is. He might be dead. And so those would be all for the taking. But it's not just those coins. There's other early miners and other early Bitcoiners who locked up their Bitcoin using this pay to pub key mechanism. But also there's a lot of Bitcoin there's a lot of Bitcoin address reuse. So a lot of like companies reuse addresses. And when they do that, that exposes the public key wasn't exposed until there's a spend, but if they reuse the address, then it's been exposed. I know that like in 2018 or 2019, Peter Wolle analyzed how many Bitcoin are exposed this way. And I think he came up with like 6-7 million Bitcoin at the time. I mean, it's a lot.
Exposed this way means if there was a pay to pub at a specific address, when that transaction gets mined, then the public key that's associated with the private key that controls that transaction gets revealed somehow or exposed?
No, there's certain Bitcoin addresses. So a Bitcoin address is, I can give you a Bitcoin address and you can pay it. Using the pay to pub key mechanism, the public key is in that address.
I see.
Whereas there's other mechanisms where I give you a Bitcoin address, such as pay to pub key hash or pay to witness script hash. And I give you a Bitcoin address and my public key is not exposed in that. It's actually been hashed a couple more times. So it's like layer upon layer of cryptography.
And that's purposely added later in the evolution of Bitcoin to try to plug a hole of the visibility.
Yeah, actually, pay to pub key hash was in the Satoshi era. I forget if it was in the initial code drop or not, or if it came quickly after that. I'm not sure. But those are protected. But then Taproot reintroduced the concept of the public key being public. and not protected, which was mildly controversial at the time. But basically, like, Peter made the case, like, there's already 7 million Bitcoin exposed. Like, this is an issue. Even if your Bitcoin is, like, protected in that way, when you go to spend it, you reveal the public key. So if an adversary has a super powerful quantum computer, they can just outbid you when your transaction's being broadcast and trying to be mined. In the best cases, neither you or the adversary gets the Bitcoin. The miner gets all the Bitcoin because you just burn right. As you compete with the adversaries. I mean, suffice it to say, essentially, again, though, it depends on the details. The quantum computer, is it so fast that it can actually, you know, solve these things within, you know, milliseconds? If so, then all Bitcoin would be exposed. If it takes like minutes, hours, days, weeks, then those who have public keys exposed, 7 million coins or whatever, would be vulnerable. But there's 7 million coins or 20 million coins. I mean, it's like, it would be a very radical event, catastrophic event. And who knows? So what do we do? I mean, whether this happens in 3 years or 50 years or 100 years, what would we do? There is cryptography, which is like quantum safe or quantum resistant. So that's good news. You know, it's part of cryptography research and development. So then
it's basically already good enough, we think, to mitigate a problem if we can figure out how to introduce it into the system.
Yes. So the obvious question is, okay, why don't you guys do that? Well, the problem is the size of the signatures are enormous. So if we thought we had scaling problems already in Bitcoin, we'd be like 1000xing, right? I don't know the exact factor, but think on the order of like 3 orders of magnitude more space needed per transaction. So it would really hurt the usefulness of Bitcoin today on something we're already hurting on scaling, and we're already trying to improve. So taking like next step backwards is not really what we want to do for a problem that might literally never occur or be 70 years. So, and also, I mean, the hope is that each and every year cryptography gets better and better and better. And so like in 20 years, there could be quantum resistant cryptography, which is maybe only like 10% bigger, you know, or negligible or something. And then it becomes kind of a no-brainer to introduce it to Bitcoin and have this gradual transition period, kind of like SegWit and Taproot. It takes like 4 to 8 years for the whole ecosystem to transition to a new technology, but it's done peacefully without any like major hurdles. So hopefully that's the way it can occur. One thing that could occur sooner than later, though, I've mentioned this Taproot a few times, and it's quite complicated, so we don't have to get into all the details, but at a really high level, one thing Taproot enables is that you can have different ways to spend your Bitcoin. So you receive Bitcoin, and instead of just like one way to spend it, you can have multiple different spending conditions. So like one could be like, I have like maybe the three of us each have a key. So it's like a 3 of 3 multi-sig. It requires all three of our keys to spend the coins. Or it only needs 2 of our 3 keys, but there's like a time lock. You have to wait, like 2 of the 3 of us can't spend it for a year. And so you can create these different conditions. Well, there could be another spending script which uses this quantum resistant cryptography. And it would only be used in the case if and when shit hits the fan and there's a quantum computer. Yeah. And the nice thing about Taproot is all the spending scripts that you have for your coins that aren't used when you spend them never need to be actually used and put on the blockchain. So even if it's really big, when you just regularly spend your coins, it would never be used. It's like just a safety valve. It's an emergency backup in case that situation occurs. And then it would be really big, but at least you have an option. And what would need to occur then is that when a quantum computer shows that it can crack all the private keys on Bitcoin, soft fork, a consensus change would be needed for Bitcoin to make it so that none of the coins could be spent using the old technique, only this new technique, and those with that power could then spend their coins. But it gets into really interesting philosophical issues, right? Such a change would then effectively freeze all coins that didn't have this upgraded path. So that gets really tricky. What's the right solution there? In particular, like Satoshi's coins. I mean, if we knew for a fact Satoshi's dead and there's no heir, and that like literally, if we just knew for a fact no one had the private key anyway, well, then we could make the ethical decision of like, okay, that's fine for those coins, but what about other people's coins? And also, we don't know that. We don't know if someone, whether it's Satoshi or an heir, has access to those coins. And you know, I think Bitcoiners hold near and dear to their heart to not ever break the principle of you shouldn't seize someone's coins. Certainly at the protocol level, to have protocol developers change the code and then everyone to adopt it to seize anyone's coins really breaks a strong principle. But that needs to be, that philosophy needs to be grappled with too as we look at solutions here.
And even if Satoshi or some of these early guys are dead, right? I mean, who knows what happens in the future? I mean, Hal Finney is cryogenically frozen, as best as I understand. So I think there are many arguments for not changing the spin conditions on those coins. But one question that still is not clear to me is, okay, so all of those kind of like gradual rollouts, it sounds like it's not perfect, but we have a decent path to get there. What happens in the case that tomorrow we wake up and, I don't know, some rogue scientist from Google is just hacking coins? I think I recall reading a quote from Satoshi saying that he believed in that kind of a case, which I would consider the worst case scenario, probably the least likely, but you never know. The Bitcoin community, which is much smaller than, would be able to find consensus and potentially, I assume he would mean a hard fork there at that point, to before the quantum, like the, you know, some agreeable block before the quantum computer came online. Do you think that would still be the case today, or is that, are we way beyond the ability to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, If at block height, you know, 1 million or whatever, that's when this attack occurred, there would obviously be a lot of public discussion about the situation. And there could become consensus that like, okay, at block height 1 million, that is the prop accurate ledger of who owns what. We fork in a chain which protects against that attack and proceed from there. I mean, there's a history lesson with Ethereum and the DAO attack.
Exactly.
So that, again, it's a really interesting philosophical discussion because like, I think a lot of humans, their instinctual reaction to like maybe the Ethereum DAO hack is like, yeah, they did the right thing. This bad person stole it or whatever. It breaks a pretty, you know, it all of a sudden takes the system, which is operates without human judgment and introduces human judgment.
Yeah.
Right.
I really think it's dangerous to cross that boundary. But I think in the scenario we're talking about, it's a really interesting discussion. So I don't have a super strong view on it other than like, it's a very non-obvious solution.
Is there action that I think most Bitcoiners abide by that principle of do as little harm as possible and only take individual action? What can someone potentially listening to this that says, okay, low risk, but low probability, but you know, big impact outcome from this? What can someone listening to this do today? Is it as simple as saying, hey, if you have any of your pub keys exposed or reused, just move any coins to a new address for which the pub key has never been exposed? Is that the kind of like practical individual action?
Yeah, honestly, I would, my advice would be not to worry about it generally. I think like much more practical, important things are just like, are you self-custodying? If not, learn more about that and self-custody. If you are, you probably could improve your OPSEC or your best practices in self-custody. So that seems like a far better use of one's time than worrying about quantum computers.
Well, this would have been a perfect time for Steve to shill his BCAP project, and he hasn't mentioned it yet. So my question is, will the BCAP project be addressing quantum as a, basically as a paper and project that Steve, Ren, and Lynn Alden put together to kind of address how consensus is formed? And effectively what we're talking about is like the most extreme kind of challenge in consensus that I think, you know, we could see coming down the road. So is there anything in this would impact sort of how you think about the stakeholders in the BCAP project?
That's a great question. I just jotted it down. It's an open source project, David. So we welcome your contribution.
Yeah. Well, I'm already thanked as a contributor, so my work here is done.
I agree with you that I think it makes like a nice chapter or appendix in the Bitcoin Consensus Analysis Project as like a scenario. Because that project, you know, the first half of the content really just sets up like, oh, here's six stakeholder groups, their powers and their motivations, stuff like that. Then right now there's a pretty deep analysis on one potential kind of reckless scenario with consensus, just to sort of educate how things could go awry. I think, but there's many types of scenarios in the future that are possible. And I agree, the one we just talked about, it would be a great write up. So I'd love to see it. This project, while there were three of us who co-authored it, we just started it. We had 24 people review it. Thank you, David. And then, but you know, it's open to, it's public now. Anyone can contribute. Would love to see someone come along and add that chapter.
Cool. Well, I think that is a lot of great context on the quantum stuff. I know that we were just chatting last night and we weren't even sure if we had enough to say. And here we are, you know, half hour in.
One final thing I wanted to just throw out, not necessarily related to Bitcoin, because again, not a quantum expert, but this has certainly piqued my curiosity and I want to go much deeper. But, you know, I definitely think for me, one takeaway also is that more impressed with and bullish on Google, you know, and I will say, I think a lot of people talked about Google not innovating as much anymore. And perhaps these are old projects that are seeing, you know, fruition now, kind of like Waymo. But I know you guys both obviously have some history there, but I think it's pretty impressive that Google is shipping like brand new science. The fact that Elon responded to Sundar's tweet with a wow, to me, it was like, wow, okay, that's pretty impressive that Google's still shipping.
Yeah, my understanding is the Willow project was started like in 2012 or something, like a long time ago. So it's, you know, I think it's these planting these seeds for a long time. There's also, you know, kind of in the surprises from Google, I think the, you know, Gemini 2 is supposed to be like pretty mind-blowing. Everybody who's sort of tried it says that it's now state-of-the-art, the best stuff out there. I haven't played with it yet, but have you had a chance to play with that? That was, I think, just dropped this week, and everybody's kind of, you know, losing their mind over it.
Yeah, I'm excited to check it out.
Better than anything out there. Cool. Did we, is Steve just taking a little bathroom break?
Steve, did we lose you?
Did we lose you? Maybe he's just like, he just kind of ghosted. He was like,
you're back now.
You're back.
Yeah, I'm back. Did we, okay. Was it just me? Or just, did we lose YouTube?
Yeah, it's all good. We just dropped. Yeah, your video dropped out, so we weren't sure if you were just trying to ghost us. My work here is done. Like, drop. Cool. So, shall we move on? We've got actually a bunch of topics here, and the other one I was thinking we could move to is Lava. So, Lava had a big announcement on Monday. They raised $10 million from Joey Krug at Founders Fund and Keith Raboy at Coastal Ventures, and this is a project that we've all been involved with and tracking for several years. But I think it's a pretty interesting one for us it highlights something pretty interesting about sort of how Silicon Valley crosses over into Bitcoin in a way that it usually doesn't. Keith in particular is one of OG fintech investors. You know, he did PayPal. He was one of the operating execs at PayPal, co-founders of Opendoor. He's done a lot in fintech over the years. He's basically made like no crypto investments. And when he saw Lava, he said, this is a special opportunity and a special entrepreneur, and I want to get behind this. So, it is, you know, it's I think notable that it didn't come from the, you know, the crypto VCs, and it kind of didn't come from all of the sort of, you know, the rest of the stuff. It kind of came from a fintech oriented perspective and a fintech investor who was leading this, because it just makes sense that this tool just fits well with the you know, as a technology tool, you know, independent of sort of the beliefs about other cryptocurrency stuff or kind of the, you know, the fever dreams there. So I thought that was like a pretty good context, but you know, I don't know, Max, do you want to give a little bit on kind of what Lava is, or kind of what your experience has been playing with it so far?
Yeah. I mean, you know, like you guys, obviously I met Shazan a couple of years ago, also invested in the company a couple of times now via HiveMind. So from very, very early days when it was just kind of a concept, but I think the concept is a very powerful one. And, you know, when you think about, to take a step back, when you think about what kinds of Bitcoin or even crypto at large, let's say Bitcoin companies have actually made money over the years, the way I think about it, there's really three categories of companies that either have made a lot of money or have the potential to make a lot of money. Four, I guess, if you count mining. So, mining is one. I know we'll touch a lot on mining. I kind of think about it in its own bucket because it's not like a pure necessarily software play. It's more of a an energy play at this point, but energy and chip play, which we'll hear about. But the three companies are obviously one, exchanges. Exchanges print money. Coinbase is probably the most successful business in the space to date. Lots of other kinds of exchanges have done very well as well. Then you have payments companies. Obviously, payments is still very early. We talked a lot about this last week with Lightning Network. We see huge potential for it. We're starting to see some revenue numbers come from payments around Bitcoin, but still very early on that. And then the third is lending. And I think that from very, very simple high level take, Bitcoin is arguably the most pristine collateral that's ever existed, right? And so, you know, much of our economy, much of the world today works based on asset-based lending. So people that take out mortgages against their homes, people that, you know, take their stocks or the other capital assets they own and use those as collateral to be able to get working capital for their lives, for their businesses, et cetera. And Bitcoin is really unique in that world because Bitcoin is something that's digital. It's something that, you know, you can easily prove that you own the control of the asset with your keys. You can easily move it anywhere in the world. The speed of light, the markets around Bitcoin operate 24/7. They're extremely liquid. They're growing. There's all these reasons that Bitcoin as collateral is just far superior than using something like, you know, a house in meat space land or, you know, other sort of capital assets that maybe work in one country like a stock, but can't be traded in another country or something like that. So I think it's well understood that there's a lot of potential around Bitcoin lending. And the market has spoken and proven that there's huge demand for it as well. So if you go back into the last, you know, bull market, there were a lot of there were a lot of excitement around companies like BlockFi and, you know, its early rocket ship growth as it was taking off because everyone wanted to use BlockFi. I mean, there's kind of two parties to that, either parties that wanted to post their Bitcoin as collateral and get US dollars to be able to, you know, use for their business or their lives or whatever, purchases like a house, a car, whatever. And then, of course, people that want to make interest, you know, earn some sort of yield on the Bitcoin that they own, potentially the dollars as well. So that's kind of the setup for this. We saw BlockFi absolutely explode. And then we also saw in terms of growth, and then we saw it actually explode. And the reason that BlockFi, of course, exploded is because when you give over the keys to your pristine collateral that can be moved anywhere 24/7 liquid markets around the world, then you open the possibility for rehypothecation, which of course is what Bitcoin was trying to solve in the first place. And so in the case of BlockFi or many of these other trading desks that took, you know, your Bitcoin as collateral, we saw them, you know, going out there doing what banks and these financial institutions are known to do, gamble with the coins or gamble with your assets and lose them. And so, you know, there's obviously a huge lesson around that. There's still, BlockFi bankruptcy proceedings that are still going through and, you know, just kind of a really complicated, terrible situation for anyone that had their Bitcoin in BlockFi. So there are other companies that have come around and tried to make, you know, sort of safer ways to take loans on your Bitcoin, things like Unchained Capital, which is a multi-sig approach where you may hold a key, they may hold a key, a third party may hold a key. And there's certainly more we can say about that. But as of today, pre-Lava, to the best of my knowledge, there is no way for you to take out a loan against your Bitcoin, against your capital asset in dollars in a way that you can use that does not force you to have any other sort of trust of any other key holder. And so Lava's value proposition is immense. The idea behind Lava is, what if you can save in Bitcoin, spend in dollars in a way that never requires you to give up your keys? So BlockFi, but you never give up custody of your Bitcoin. And it's an extremely powerful idea. Now, the technicals behind this, I'm sure, you know, DK, you're probably deepest in that. You can go, you know, at a higher level into it, but, you know, from the TLDR, uses DLCs or discrete log contracts, a type of smart contracting on Bitcoin that uses oracles or price feeds, such that you can post just like you would have in BlockFi. You know, if I want to post one Bitcoin as collateral, I can then take out, you know, half the value of that in US dollars denominated, I think, as USDC, or be able to move it into a bank account and use that however I want. I have a loan term. I have an interest rate set, all set by the free market, just as I would with any other lending market. But again, the key insight, the key value proposition is, I don't have to give up my keys to a third party who can then take it and gamble and lose my coins and leave me bankrupt. So that's what Lava is trying to solve. We know it's a huge multi-billion dollar opportunity, potentially even bigger as Bitcoin grows as a capital asset. And obviously it's early. I think all of us have played with it to some degree, maybe taking out very small loans. So I wouldn't say it's ready to take on that whole market yet, but their solution is novel. It seems like it's working and everyone knows the market's big. So I think it's really exciting.
And sorry, I know that I dropped, so I might have missed some of this if you guys already covered. But have you talked about sort of the concepts of, there's Bitcoin in Lava that you're sort of self-custodied Bitcoin or sort of bring your own custody. And then there are stable coins or digital dollars that you
are borrowing. And you can off-ramp those. Either you could send them to another wallet, or you can off-ramp them to a bank dollar if you actually want to use it to, you know, pay a bill or something like that. And it sounds like, Steve, you're saying the volume is too low. Is it tough to?
Yeah, you're a little quiet.
Sorry, I've got internet issues.
But that's exactly right. Like what DK was saying, you post collateral, never give up your keys. You can get your dollars as USDC or into the traditional banking system, so you can use it.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that people who've been looking at this are pointing out and really excited about is because, like, I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who grew up in South Africa, and he said everybody in South Africa would want this kind of thing, but they want to be able to, like, borrow in rand, the local currency. And there's actually a whole other market that could emerge around people who maybe don't want to take dollar risk, but they actually want to be able to borrow in their local currency, but Lava may not take that on. But because Lava is not taking custody of the coin, they actually don't need to KYC people who use the protocol. So it really enables the thing to scale globally very quickly because it's just kind of a smart contract. And you could imagine other businesses like the Rand dollar kind of bridge or some sort of arbitrage or sort of secondary lending market that could emerge around that. So there's, I think, just like a lot of opportunity, and it's moving very quickly that Lava is. So I'm excited to play with it a bit more as a lender. I haven't tried, I've done some of that on testnet, but I haven't tried that on mainnet yet. But that's kind of my next to do. And it sounds like, I think you guys have each used the borrowing facility on mainnet already.
Yes, I have.
I've tried. There are some issues with my loan, but it's in theory works, but we're working a couple things out with my phone.
Cool. Have you either of you tried?
So I've taken out like $100 loan, and my next step right now, I have it in stable coins, and I'm going to try to transfer it to my bank and just sort of prove that out.
And so you've borrowed stable coins as USDC, right?
Nope. I don't think that's possible. I didn't see a option to choose.
I thought they had the option in there. Like I saw you could see what is denominated in Lava USD and USDC. I don't know if they've enabled USDC loans yet.
Right. Okay. I see both, but I did not see both as an option when I took out the loan. It just decided it for me. And then I have a balance of zero USDC because there's no way. I mean, I guess maybe I can transfer USDC to this wallet, but I don't know how to take out a loan in USDC.
Okay, one of the first ones.
My understanding, though, that's still, that specific part of Lava is still being developed, and they're really focused on customer user experience and making that pretty seamless, so you don't have to like understand any of these technical details about underlying platforms and stuff.
Yep.
It'll be interesting. I think it'll be interesting to see how it evolves. Like, are customers immediately taking the dollar loan they get and transferring it to some other cryptocurrency ecosystem, be it within Solana or Ethereum or whatever, and doing trading or some kind of smart contract? Or are they transferring it to a traditional bank and then getting traditional dollars to spend it? I think it'll be interesting to see how that evolves, and Lava will need to see which becomes more popular, and they can optimize user experience around.
Yeah, and I also think you're going to see different user experiences for different use cases, because as DK, as you were saying, Lava is a protocol. And so you could potentially build this into all kinds of different apps. I mean, two things that I was, and you know, again, caveat to everyone, Lava is very exciting, but it's obviously early. It's part of the reason they're raising this big round to be able to continue to build out, you know, some of these features. But two things that I would love to see for two different use cases. One, personally, I mean, the phone, you know, is cool for taking a couple $100 or something like that. Some spending money. However, if I were going to do something larger for, you know, purchase like a house or something like that, I would want to see this as something on my desktop, something that, like, I don't know, just feels, at least to me, maybe I'm a bit of a boomer, a bit more scarce. So I'm assuming that's going to roll out. And then to the use case that you talked about, DK, I think it's really interesting for me to see this for like just daily spending, particularly in emerging markets. I think for that, you know, we still don't have like network integration for Bitcoin deposits or withdrawals yet. And eventually, I think if we end up getting stable coins that are somehow compatible either on top of or with the Lightning Network, that becomes very powerful as well. Because my guess is, you know, for someone in, say, I could see a world where Lava ends up integrating with exchanges, let's say like a Bitnob in Nigeria, right, or Yopaki in Mexico or in some of these countries. But then, you know, what you're effectively saying is you're giving the sort of hack that the rich have always had of using capital assets to get cash, which we know depreciates, versus capital assets to 8 billion people, which is awesome, assuming people know how to use it kind of responsibly and don't end up, accidentally losing all their money, which is a whole other topic. But eventually, I think that user experience can be sort of built for it and taught. But then I think you need people basically able to, as I believe Saylor once said, you know, many years ago, in sort of his vision for Bitcoin, be able to say, hey, take out a loan, instantly say, you know, here's $20 worth of Bitcoin. I need $10 worth of my local currency so I can go and in real time, all in under a few seconds, you know, pay for my tacos or whatever I'm buying.
There's a detail around how Lava works, which kind of has always, it sort of shifted my perspective on Bitcoin or the broader crypto ecosystem, which is, I know that Shazan is, you know, a believer that stablecoins are useful for making payments today, like USD, USDC, however you want to, USDT, or maybe Lava USD, that it's kind of a useful or sort of necessary way to bridge into the kind of traditional financial ecosystem. But that I think Shazan believes strongly that stablecoins should not be on Bitcoin, and that it kind of creates a bunch of risk to have Bitcoin have its own stablecoin in some way. I don't want to misrepresent his view, but that's kind of how I would summarize my understanding of it. And so with Lava, a lot of the hard technical work that Lava does is it figures out how to bridge what is known on Bitcoin with what is known on another chain. I think he's done a lot. It's sort of, some of it is obfuscated or mostly kind of just buried and abstracted because it's not super important for the user experience. But I think it's actually bridging out to like a USDC that happens to be on Solana. And so in a world where we're, you know, very Bitcoin oriented, and I think none of us are typically very excited about all these other cryptocurrencies, but it seems like you couldn't actually build this type of tool without some way to use USDC. And what does that future look like? Like, is it USDC can run on Solana, doesn't matter, could run on Ethereum, could run on something else? Is there any proposal or hypothesis for how you could run a stablecoin that's not on Bitcoin, but that is on some other thing that doesn't necessarily try to be its own cryptocurrency, but just like as a way to support USDC execution? Any thoughts or knowledge on anything?
Totally. I mean, I think personally, this is one of the ideas that I am most excited about. And if anyone is listening to this, an entrepreneur thinking about how to build this, you know, I've taken some sort of shots on goal here, but I want to continue to invest in this kind of a company. And the idea for the company is, so to be clear, to take a step back, I don't know where this is going to go. I mean, I remain open-minded. I understand Shazan's point of view. I'm not sure if that's right or not, maybe. You know, I still think there's a chance we get dollars directly on Bitcoin. And of course, the benefit of doing that is interoperability, right? The ability to swap between Bitcoin and those dollars instantly, use them on the Lightning Network, which means on the Lightning Network, unlike any other blockchain, I think this is important to understand, because it's peer-to-peer routed, whereas blockchains have to share global state, because of just the laws of physics, that means you can get instant final settlement versus waiting for all those nodes to sync, which is why Solana is always famously going down. And even, you know, by sacrificing decentralization, which is the point of a blockchain, it still can't get the kind of instant final settlement that a peer-to-peer routed network could. So that's one of the reasons you want dollars somehow interoperable with Bitcoin and being able to move on the Lightning Network. So we have to get that somehow. Maybe it's something like Taproot Assets or RGB or all these different proposals that have come before. Maybe it's not. Obviously, we haven't seen it yet. The thing that makes the most sense to me, and I think Shazan agrees with this view as well, is to build Lightning Network bridges between Bitcoin, which is where all the capital stays, and all these, what I'll call spending or payment networks. And so the way I think about it is, in late 2017, December 2017, John Pfeffer put out a piece talking about the sort of utility token thesis. And the idea was, save in Bitcoin, and then, you know, you can transfer in real time to your Chuck E. Cheese token on whatever network you want to be able to use that machine. Or even as Leishman at River calls it, your IRS utility tokens, if that's what you need. So in order to do that, though, you can potentially build a bridge between Bitcoin and whatever chain you're spending on without even touching the native token. Like, so you could have USDC on Solana or on Tron or whatever. And the idea is that you could basically do an instant swap via the Lightning Network between Bitcoin and the dollar on that chain. And I think that whoever ends up building the best bridge between Bitcoin and those chains, and dollars on those chains, and can sit there and kind of market make between those two chains has the opportunity to build the biggest exchange and something like, I think, a bigger business than Coinbase. This is where I think we're all going. The requirements, again, are it needs to be interoperable with Bitcoin instantly and needs to be able to access the Lightning Network instantly as well. Doesn't have to be on Bitcoin, although I think on a 100-year time horizon, I think the elegance of that is going to win out. But in the next 10 years, I could totally see it living on these other chains, and someone's going to sit there and just market make all day between them.
Cool. Steve, any other thoughts on Lava that you wanted to share?
Nope.
Cool. All right, let's, I mean, it's fun to play with it. Actually, in
Shazam, you exhaust me from the quantum computing conversation.
Yeah, you're like, got to take a little breather, let Matt up a little. That's all good.
I do think it's worth mentioning one last thing, DK. You brought this up at the beginning, but and maybe both of you guys have comments on this because I think it's important. To me, I don't think we can overstate also the significance enough. And this is something that also I think a lot of, as you know, a very early stage investor focused on Bitcoin is, you know, it has been a long, hard, uphill battle to get traditional Silicon Valley Series A funds to be interested in Bitcoin. And the reason is, in my experience, you know, all of the traditional smart investors, they had a fork in the road. They went one of two ways. They either went full degen in crypto, either for lack of understanding or because that's where they were making money by taking tokens and dumping on retail. It is what it is. So you have got that segment of Silicon Valley. And then you've got the other segment of Silicon Valley, which largely because of the first segment of Silicon Valley, looks at everything cryptocurrency and just lumps Bitcoin in with it and says, nah, this is some degenerate gambling stuff. It's kind of gross. They're dumping on retail. I'm just not interested. Keep that stuff away from me. I do real tech. And so you've got these two camps, which sadly has left those of us in Bitcoin who identify with neither of those camps kind of in no man's land. There's been very few. I mean, there's some specialized capital, obviously funds like mine, but very small. Some that are a little bit larger that can do some Series A's. But we really haven't had, with a few rare exceptions, Series A or Series B funds that are willing to come in with real capital, with, you know, real expertise and connections that can help these companies scale, come up and pony up large checks for Bitcoin-only companies. And so, you know, particularly, obviously, Founders Fund, to a degree, they've done some of their crypto stuff, but particularly Cosla coming in, not being a Bitcoin fund, not being a crypto fund and doing this, my hope, I'm curious what you guys think, but I hope this is a big first step to starting to kind of open the floodgates a little bit for traditional Silicon Valley to come in and be like, oh yeah, like Bitcoin's real. You know, it's not, has nothing to do with crypto. And I hope that means we'll see a lot more Series A and Series B financings in the coming years from traditional funds that can actually help these companies a lot.
Yeah, I think there is like a perception, like the you know, perception and branding problem that Bitcoin gets too lumped in with crypto for like VCs. And the problem that it creates is that if you're a good VC, you should be hyper aware of the risk of adverse selection. You don't want to be getting stuff that's already been looked at by everybody else in market and they've decided no, and now you need to look at it. It's like, well, if all the smart people who follow this stuff have already said no, why is it showing up on my desk, right? Like if it's on my desk, it must be that it's already been picked over. People are, I think they're astute to be cautious of adverse selection. And I think that Bitcoin crypto branding is actually what kind of causes some of that confusion, is because there's a lot of Bitcoin entrepreneurs who don't want to work with crypto focused funds. They'd rather work with like just a traditional business builder type. But the business builder types, if they hear that, they hear Bitcoin, they think crypto, and they figure that, oh, it must have already been picked over by people who, you know, have looked at, who look at like all the crypto stuff. So there's like a little bit of a mismatch there. And I think, you know, there's, I think Heath is kind of coming at it, as best I understand, just saying like, you know, I'd say probably, you know, believes in Bitcoin, probably pretty skeptical of the rest of the stuff, but he sees a real fintech opportunity here in borrowing and lending. And so I think that's something that, you know, there's few examples that I can point to in the Bitcoin ecosystem that are as strong or clear a use case. So I think the way to actually get more capital into this is actually find more and better use cases where it's like, you can look at Lava and be like, look, there's hundreds of billions of dollars of demand already expressed, product market fit on things like BlockFi. And just like, it was the technical, structural, architectural problem with how that was built. And this is just a different hypothesis, different approach to a problem that has insane product market fit. But it's not like people are taking crazy risk, you know, product market fit risk at this point. I think Keith is saying this is a great business and this is a great entrepreneur. And that might be a little bit of an N of one. So I think you can get more capital in, but capital is actually fairly rational and probably much less ideological than maybe even like us. We're like, okay, how do we help how do we help Bitcoin win? And part of that is maybe having a bunch of excitement for Bitcoin-focused investments. Whereas if we want to, if we, you know, these investments need to compete with the very best AI opportunity out there, right? So you have to, I think you have to temper, like, Bitcoin or no Bitcoin, Bitcoin investments are competing with every AI investment out there, if you're talking about like top tier investors. So I think it's good to be cognizant of that and say, like, do we have a really strong value prop? Is there a really strong product market fit here? Really strong reason that this business should exist? And like Bitcoin is just like kind of a detail. It's not like necessarily front and center. But anyway, that's a little bit more color on sort of, I think, what's going on here. I think we'll see the floodgates open when we see the great ideas with strong product market fit kind of coming fast at us.
Yep. I agree with both of you guys. I agree, David, that's the bar that needs to be met for there to be a lot of Bitcoin companies funded. But I agree with Max's enthusiasm that I think we have seen real material progress in that direction.
And I would just put one other counterpoint. I mean, I generally agree with that too. Like, obviously we have to the right entrepreneurs and obviously the right business models, but like, I do think, you know, as smart as a lot of this capital is, I don't believe in the efficient market hypothesis, even among the top tier Silicon Valley VCs. Sure. I sincerely do believe if that were the case, you wouldn't just see MicroStrategy gobbling up Bitcoin today, right? Like you would have seen companies and a lot of people just gobbling this up from 2011 on. And some of them dipped their toes, got scared and dipped out. So to me, I think that's true. But I also think that a lot of these people wrote Bitcoin off based on an incorrect understanding of what it was. And I think that's going to change.
Yeah. And I, by the way, I'm not arguing markets are efficient, especially not in private early stage venture. They're crazy, messy, complex. There's chaos all over. But I do think like you should hold any given company to a high bar. And if it's showing up on your desk, you should be asking the question, even as a professional investor or even an angel, you should be asking the question like, why are they talking to me? And if the answer is like, oh, they probably got picked over by 10 other smart people, it doesn't mean that there's no opportunity. Still could be plenty of opportunity. There are enough smart people looking at it that they should be able to generate some signal before it sort of gets all the way down. So it doesn't mean that there's no chance, but it's just like additional evidence, additional information that you have to digest and incorporate in the decision there. Hopefully I think the best thing this could do, the lava, both the funding announcement as well as the market traction they've already got and are going to, just like the obvious use case, I think it could inspire the next wave of entrepreneurs and founders to understand like what does great look like. And I think Lava is a great, like it happens to be a Bitcoin related company, but I think it's just a great company, great entrepreneur. And I think that can inspire the next wave of great entrepreneurs to say, oh, actually you can build really substantial, meaningful stuff in Bitcoin. Like, it doesn't matter if the VCs care about it. It matters like this entrepreneur and this opportunity is great.
Yeah, I do want to add just one more point of color to that. I will say part of my view on this is colored from when I was a more traditional VC and doing some of the crypto stuff and talking with a lot of these tier one funds and being told in my face, quote, decentralization doesn't seem to really matter. And that was the moment when, I'm not saying this is the case in everything, but I started to question, like, I think the emperor may have no clothes in certain situations. So again, yes, my hope is that this will inspire more tier one entrepreneurs, because I do think we've had a lack of those, partially because the capital wasn't there to come out. But I don't know, I definitely, going down this whole Bitcoin journey, one of the biggest lessons it taught me was if you've done the work and you really believe in something, the people that are really, really smart, they could still be missing something. So
yep.
That's my bet.
Yep. All right. We've got a ton of stuff and we've already kind of blown through our time. So let's move along. We've got this phishing attack hardware wallets point. Steve shared this link. And I think somebody was talking about they had a Ledger hardware wallet with, I think, 10 Bitcoin on it and $1.5 million worth of NFTs. They were storing on a Ledger Nano S. The Ledger was purchased directly from Ledger. The seed phrase was stored in a secure location, never entered anywhere online. I never signed any malicious transactions. Everything is in my physical possession. I haven't touched this Ledger in 2 months. Can you explain what happened? So there's that question of, was somebody screwing up how they were using the Ledger, or were they sort of like misusing it? And Steve chimed in and said, I'm still not sure of the specific case. If the community note is to be believed and it was a phishing attack, then designs like BitKey clearly address it well, as they don't put private key material directly in the hands of the customer, eliminating this attack vector. So Steve, is this talking about sort of in the Ledger case, we're assuming it was probably like a single signature and the private key material was in the hands of the user, and in BitKey there's kind of a multi-sig setup. Is that the core distinction you're making here?
Yeah, I mean, this person's story sort of made the rounds yesterday. I thought it was, but it's not a one-off. I mean, people have lost, people have had coins stolen from them. And then the question is always, well, one question should always be, is this person telling the truth? Is it real? There's always the boating accident cover-up story. But then if it is real, then how did they lose the coins? Because we all want to learn, because we all want to see, are we at risk? Yep. And are there ways to improve products? So these are always eventful situations. And also, like this person sort of insinuated that it was Ledger's fault. So it's always important to investigate, like, was a product at fault or not? The community note on it says that it was a phishing attack. I didn't actually find sufficient evidence to convince me that's true. Like, it seemed to presume that they found evidence a few years ago on chain on either Ethereum that somehow demonstrated that there's a phishing attack. I didn't really see that evidence. Maybe it was the case that there was a known phishing attack in that era. They knew the addresses of the attacker and they could see the coins moving from this person's wallet to the attacker. Maybe I don't know, but it doesn't actually matter the truth of this particular case, because we definitely know other people have been phished before and had their cryptocurrency stolen. In fact, I have a friend who I grew up with, as new as a teenager, who about 4 years ago, he was doing all the right things. He owned a Bitcoin. He self-custodied. He hodled. He wasn't like a day trader. And so he's doing all the right things. And then he had all his coins stolen from him. It's a horrible situation. What did he do? Something like a normal human person, human being does. He actually bought more Bitcoin on Coinbase, wanted to transfer it to a self-custody solution. So he used Trezor web wallet at the time, which at the time was Trezor's wallet. And they didn't have a native client. So like if you bought the Trezor product, the software wallet that they told you to use was the Trezor web wallet. He went to Google. He typed in Trezor web wallet. He clicked on the first link at Google. Google's been around 20 plus years, super trustworthy, right? The first link, you got to trust it, right? You might even be savvy enough to know that Google has a policy not to allow cryptocurrency companies to advertise on Google. Well, it turns out this was an advertisement. It turns out it is true that Trezor, the company, is unable to advertise, but a thief is able to advertise on Google. Completely embarrassing. So the first link was a phishing site. You click on it, it looks exactly like Trezor web wallet. So you can see how, and this person was busy. They were on their lunch break from work, and they just wanted to like quickly transfer the coins they just bought to their self-custody, because that's the thing to do. Luckily for them, the Trezor web wallet told them to plug in their Trezor. They did that. And then it said, oh, your Trezor had a hardware failure. Please type in your 12 seed words to recover. So, so if you understand the implications of that, and this person actually did, they told me as soon as they typed it in and hit return, they had a pit in their stomach. And they had a pit in their stomach for a good reason, because their Bitcoin was instantly stolen when they did that. This person is not a dummy. He's just a normal person. If we want Bitcoin to go mainstream, if we want self-custody to be something that any person should be able to use, we need to overcome problems like that. So phishing attacks are real. So the point I made in, so how do we improve products? Well, one reason I'm a huge advocate of the design of the BitKey wallet, and I really hope to see many more products in the space adopt this type of design, is that it just eliminates this vector of attacks, because it doesn't give the customer nearly as many foot guns as most other products in the space do. And specifically, the customer does not have private direct access to private key material. So most hardware wallets, when you buy them, you generate your private key on the device, and then you write down like 12 words, and then you have to figure out how to safely store them. And that can be dangerous for a wide variety of reasons, one of them being phishing attacks, but there's many, many, many other foot guns, many foot guns. And some of us have spent hundreds of hours thinking through all the details of this to avoid it. So if you just don't give the customer access to the private keys, you just eliminate all of that mess. Now, historically, if the customer doesn't have access to the right keys, it typically required tons of trust. It might be custodial, or it wasn't self-sovereign. If like the provider you're using goes away, you lose access to your coins. The beauty of the BitKey design is that you're still self-sovereign. The company behind it can turn off the servers, go away. Even some crazy situation where like Apple and Block and the government collude to remotely remove the app from your phone, you still have unilateral access to your coins. So it's a really clever design. So it eliminates this type of attack. So I'm a big proponent of spreading the news on that type of design. I think it's revolutionary for private key management. I think it's a necessary step to make it mainstreamable. And I really hope to see it become really popular and common among many products in the space.
We've talked about BitKey just offline plenty, and I would love to even just do like a whole deep dive on that, but we don't have time to get into all those details today. But is it true, if I understand what you're saying, is that the design of BitKey is itself open source, and is there a kind of a encouraging an ecosystem of other hardware vendors to adopt that similar design and kind of build other competitive products? Is that part of what you're saying?
Anyone can choose. The architecture has been detailed in a paper, and it's free for others to, you know, take that architecture, use it, make it better, build upon it. Source code for BitKey is published source, not free open source. So that's notable. Publishing, so if you do want to take the code and use it, you need to get a license. But it's available for auditing. It's available for reproducible builds. So there's some positive things for having published source, the two I just mentioned. But yeah, I mean, I'm not like promoting, oh, go partner with Block. I'm just saying, like, here's this incredible revolutionary UX. Like, others should build products that use that and make it even better. Because BitKey is not a perfect product either, right? And even the BitKey team plans to, you know, they have a roadmap. They're trying to improve their product. They have lots of great ideas, but you know, there's many other great entrepreneurs and companies in the space that could create different wallets as well. I mean, one thing that's very clear to me, there's not the custody solutions. There's not a winner take all. Like, there's no one product that's going to solve everyone's needs. There's like dozens of different use cases. And so I think there'll be dozens of successful products in this space. And hundreds or thousands of attempts, but you can build that. I think there'll be dozens of successful companies building custody solutions, self custody.
Did you get Max a BitKey for Christmas?
I already got one.
Don't spoil the surprise, man.
But if I do get a new one, I wouldn't say no either.
How many of you bought BitKey for your friends and family for Christmas?
I have purchased like 10 or so to give to friends and family, and I actually think that's going to be really popular with BitKey. Because if you just take the million plus people who are in the space who already have hardware wallets and they're already used to, you know, dealing with seed phrases and all this stuff, they may or may not want to switch to BitKey. But I think they have, for each one person in Bitcoin who self-custodies, they have like 10 or 20 friends and family members who are on Binance or Coinbase or Cash App or some exchange. And I think that you get this like 10x or 20x multiplying factor of recommending BitKey as the right product to get people off exchanges.
For that hardcore group, I mean, it makes total sense to me that BitKey is something that can make self-custody go mainstream, which is awesome, and orders of magnitude more people. For that hardcore group, would you say that BitKey is already, in your opinion, it sounds like you're already obviously using it, but is it something that you think is, you know, something that someone that's using a Trezor or a cold card or a ledger or whatever today, it already makes sense for them to move over? Or what would you say are the trade-offs?
In general, my guidance to anyone for any new product, including BitKey, is like, I would not transfer like all your Bitcoin from Trezor or cold card or whatever you're using today, all of it to BitKey in one fell swoop. I'd recommend getting one, playing with it, getting comfortable with it, transferring a small amount, get comfortable with over a period of time, 6 or 12 months. If you're comfortable, if you're confident, you understand it, and you, you know, and there's been no notable security concerns, then transfer more. And then over a series of years, you can transfer more and more and more. And then, you know, people are going to have different different calculus on this, but I think one reasonable approach is that you put a portion on BitKey and a portion on your do-it-yourself solution. But there's, I don't think there's one size fits all. The amount of Bitcoin a person has, the percentage of their net worth, where they're at in their Bitcoin journey, and they're, all of those factors come to play here. Yeah, so I think, but yeah, I would not recommend someone who has a ton of Bitcoin on a treasury today just insta moves it to all the BitKey. But I think it's a good idea for Bitcoiners to get a BitKey or play with one. Because again, I think the much more likely case is that you're going to recommend it to your 10 or 20 friends and family members who aren't, they're scared of the foot guns of self-custody. It's intimidating to them. And BitKey is a much more approachable product. I do think, you know, taking a portion of your Bitcoin and putting on BitKey, even if you really know what you're doing, you're still at risk of foot guns. Any of us are at risk of foot guns, no matter how much we've studied it. So diversify your custody and putting some on BitKey, there could be a logic to that as well.
Yeah. And do you think, are there any other hardware vendors, like existing players like, you know, Trezor, Coldcard, et cetera, who've made any kind of public statement about where they might be going? Like, do you think, like, will Trezor start kind of implementing some BitKey-like UX at some point, or kind of architecture?
I've not seen that or heard that. So I'm not sure, but I'm going to keep singing the praises. For everyone, in case you don't know, I work for Block. Block makes BitKey, but I'm actually not on the team. So think of me as like someone shilling the design more than the product, but because it's the only product that supports that design, I would also recommend the product in a lot of situations. But yeah, I'm going to continue being a champion of the design. I would love to see existing and new hardware wallet vendors adopt this design and make it even better.
And did you say right now you think there's about a million hardware wallets or self-custody kind of individuals who self-custody Bitcoin with hardware wallets?
I mean, I think Ledger's, I don't know exactly how many Ledger's sold, but I think it's like 5 to 10 million or something that they've sold. I assume they're the leader, you know, and then so then you add in like CoinKite's products and Trezor, and I don't know, maybe the total is 10 million. But then a lot of us who are nerds in cryptocurrency own like 10 each. And then also like a lot of people are, they own multiple coins and are just focused on Bitcoin. So is it 1 million? Is it 10 million? It depends on what you're counting. What's your question?
Well, I just wanted to try to get a sense, like if there's about a million or so who are currently doing kind of the very challenging way, and if this maybe, you know, the BitKey design and product opens up maybe an order of magnitude more usage, does that move us from 1 million to 10 million? Or if we're already at 10, does it get us to 100 million of self-custodied? Mm-hmm. Or I'm just trying to kind of get a...
I think Trust Wallet has like 100 million or something, right? So, that's the big number right now.
What is Trust Wallet?
Yeah.
It's like a cryptocurrency wallet. It's a mobile cryptocurrency self-custody wallet.
Okay.
Like a Binance bought them. So I assume Binance is a big distribution vehicle for it. It's not like a Bitcoin wallet. So, you know, if you're doing Ethereum and other coins and stuff.
Right. Got it.
So a lot of the Ethereum DeFi stuff drove self-custody usage because you needed to be self-custody to use them. So I suspect that drove a lot of Trust Wallet adoption.